not from the point of view of doing things for the ghetto dweller, but rather doing things with it. He wants to control, at least to some extent, these new efforts. He wants to be in on the decision-making process. And he wants a piece of the economic action himself. He recognizes that ghetto real estate and urban redevelopment programs are sources of potential profit for the business community. Some of his leaders are already talking about corporate imperialism and the business being interested in the ghetto only as a market for products and government finance services. It will be necessary for business to employ the same kinds of techniques it has used in establishing a presence in the fiercely nationalistic, less developed countries in respect of the ghettos of the United States. As in those situations, in Africa and in Latin America and in other parts of the world in which American business has such great experience, it will be necessary to establish joint venture and to give local management a place in order really to do the job. Also, we must think of forms of employee and community, profit sharing, and stock option arrangements. In short, we must put the ghetto community into business, not simply bring the business establishment to the ghetto. The slum dweller wants to be more than an employee. He wants to be a capitalist too, in a very real sense of the word. And as one street leader put it to me recently, if you scratch a Milton, you come up with a republic. And I'll tell you a very interesting thing about that, which bears upon this point. I have a dear friend and colleague who's a real whip, George Murphy, senator from California. And he sits next to me on the Committee on Labor and Public Welfare, and we heard Abernathy and the others in the Four People's Campaign. They came to us first in order to testify when they came to Washington. And when he heard them talking about private enterprise, and everybody wants to be in business for themselves, and they want a piece of the action, and they want to live like dignified, important human beings, he turned to me and he said, "Jack, they sound like Republicans." And indeed they did. Now, I don't say this in a partisan sense. It's just the fact that we are popularly identified as the party of business. I happen to be proud of it. Some Republicans apologize for it. But the important thing is, as I told my party, if we're the party of business, then let's make business work in the public interest. And the same with business. If business is going to do a job in the slums, make the slums your partner. And that's the way to get the job done the best for them and with the most social and economic usefulness to them. Now, there's a whole host of new techniques to be used in that regard. And I'm going to close with one example. The Eastman Kodak Company was in a terrific, very disagreeable struggle with social and local action organizations in Rochester. And I'm the senator from New York, and I was deeply concerned and very worried about it. This is a very important company which literally almost dominates the economic life of that city, and we had a lot of trouble in Rochester, as many of you may know. How was it solved? Finally, in a long last, it was solved when a consortium of the business community of Rochester, including Eastman Kodak, and the militants themselves got together in a job organization. And when they were on the inside, two things happened. One, there were more jobs. And two, there was more tranquility. When they were on the outside fighting, they couldn't see anything but total victory for just what they wanted, even if it was impossible. Now, this is the essence of what we're about. I know of no greater individual event that could reverse what happened in the American people's verdict on business in 1932, that's a long time ago, 36 years, from which business has been suffering ever since, then the business picking up this opportunity and being successful with it. But I say, don't let government off the hook. Don't let government off the hook for two reasons. One, in the transitional period until business is really ready, and two, because there's always an essential and creative role for government. And don't let the word no scare you. There are lots of times when the administrators have said no, as they're doing now about tax incentives, and they've come around to it, and they'll come around again. If business really feels strong, which the tremendous crisis in the American cities requires to be done. And there's a really golden chalice at the end of this effort, because this is the real way in which to bring about people's capitalism in this country. And the whole genius of the American system, the whole concept of trustee management, the whole opportunity of the wide distribution of ownership through stocks and bonds and through profit sharing, bringing the American system into its full maturity as a real object lesson for all of mankind, not only in economics, but in democracy, is right at the threshold, and it's all hazarded upon this turn of the wheel in respect of what we can do with poverty in the United States. And so the opportunity is great, the prize is enormous, and as is therefore true in all great decisions, let's really be sure that we have the means in our hands and that we don't let anybody, including government, escape from its responsibility. Thank you very much.
Becomes also a direct equipment for, in relation to, life and improvement. in the community in which the college is located. This is uniquely a function of the community college. I know that Porter Chandler has it much in mind, and so has our Board of Higher Education, as do also the governor of the state, Governor Rockefeller, and Mayor Lindsay, and the state education authority under Commissioner Hart. I'd like to talk with you today about this passion for social change, how it may be attained, the problems raised for us by violence in seeking to attain it, such as we saw at Columbia University, and generally a rather face-on view, or as the saying now goes so popularly, telling it as it is, in terms of my own relationship as a major government official up to this situation. Though I cannot speak at every commencement of this kind in the state, I hope that this will be typical enough to get the message to the thousands of students and their families and friends and communities who I think ought to have. The horror and the madness in Los Angeles which has taken Senator Kennedy from us to compel each of us to reflect anew upon the kind of society we live in and what course we must set for ourselves. Senator Kennedy was my colleague, but he was also my friend. And he had, more than many political leaders, the capacity to inspire the young people of our country. He knew that the young were troubled by the world as they find it, and they want a change which will instill a stronger sense of purpose and of meaning in their lives. Today, already, more than half of our people in the United States are 25 years of age or younger. These young people are coming to set the style and the tone of American life. This is a perplexed and impassioned generation. It's prepared to challenge authority. It's ready to question long-established institutions. It seeks to expose everything in American life that's hypocritical. This generation is saying that we have not done and have not yet begun to do nearly enough to redress the accumulated grievances of our people. That the promise of our great democracy remain unfulfilled. This is the discrepancy between things as they are and things as they ought to be that has led to what some call the confrontation of generations. This confrontation exists because much of what older generations regard as success fails to impress our young people. Often the young are revolted by the turbulence and the spirit of unbridled affluence within our society, and they often do not see that this is an essential concomitant of our productive power and what has produced our real wealth. Many of them are opposed to the Vietnam War, which they feel is immoral. Many are enraged by the propensity of what they regard as a crassly materialistic society to ignore the want, the injustice, the hopelessness, which afflicts a significant minority estimated somewhere between 16 and 20% of our people. While the younger generation has many laudable qualities, one of them is not a great deal of tolerance of their elders. Of course, we know, do we not, that the young alone didn't create music and art, nor develop by themselves the precepts of peace, understanding, loving kindness, and the dignity of man. And on the other hand, is the older generation alone responsible for all the war, the prejudice, and the greed in the world? I think not. Will all these evils be gone forever when we pass away? I think not either. So the first prerequisite for a better society, which must surely be the aim of all, is to establish a dialogue between the generations. All too often, younger people hear without understanding what the adult world is trying to say. And unhappily for all of us, the adult world often condemns its progeny without listening or listening with but half an ear to what the message is that the young are trying to give to us. But young and old do have something to say to one another. For both generations are deeply affected by senseless acts of violence. Both generations are appalled by what's happened in Vietnam. Both generations are dismayed by poverty, ignorance, and inequality in our country, the most most affluent on earth. This poverty and ignorance and inequality which affects the lives of millions within both generations, there are those who keenly feel that there is danger in a mass-produced, punch-card society whose technological achievements threaten at times to take over our own destinies. But it's not enough simply to talk with each other. We have to set out some basic, mutually agreed-upon assumptions that will govern the conduct of our lives. And foremost among these must be the principle that violence has no place in the democratic process, and that achievements in righting the very injustices against which violence is designed to protest is the highest form of human satisfaction. Now, the National Advisory Committee on Civil Disorders, the so-called Kerner Commission, in discussing the urban riots, said, and I quote, "Violence cannot build a better society. Disruption and disorder nourish repression, not justice. They strike at the freedom of every citizen. The community cannot and will not tolerate coercion and mob rule," end of quote from the commission. Now, Fidel Castro, one of the leading exponents of revolution, has said, and I quote, "It is the duty of a revolutionary to make revolution," end of quote. But let us not forget that the politics of revolution carry within them the seeds of massive repression by the threatened majority. Can these self-styled revolutionaries in our midst safely assume that their enemies will not dare to fight back, that the majority has no guns, no anger, no cause? Indeed, the use of violence and the defiance of law, as long, and I emphasize it, if you remember nothing else of what I say, please remember this phrase. The use of violence and the defiance of law, as long as we have available to us the means to change laws peacefully. This cannot be condoned, even when the ultimate objectives are legitimate. The idea that one can pick and choose the laws he will obey carries with it the grave risk of irresponsible anarchy. No matter how ardent an opposition an individual may be, let us remember, no matter how deeply we're convinced that we're right, that there are 200 million other Americans to be considered and heard too. Violence is not acceptable to them as a means of social change in our society. Hence, those who break the law, and I include leaders of student protests, must be called to account, and they should know that they must bear full responsibility for their actions. If they wish to take that risk in order to make a protest, the decision must be theirs. But risk it is, and society cannot grant amnesty as a condition for violent protest. Violence cannot be the instrument of change or reform, because our institutions are capable of change without us. We have seen that this year. We witnessed the concerted pressure of young people acting through the political process, notably in the campaign of Senator McCarthy, directly affecting United States foreign policy and fundamentally altering the course of our republic. History reveals that violence often brings rapid change within a society. But we must ask ourselves whether the rejection of the governmental process in order to redress wrongs does in fact lead to a better society than the one which has been challenged. What it really comes down to is whether the price of violent change is worth paying in our society, where change is possible without it. And so I urge you, and urge all young people, let us look for a new way to proceed, a way that will utilize the vigor of our young people. And I would like to give you three prescriptions in that regard. And as you all know, I'm no Stan Patter. I believe in the dynamism of movement and change, and I yield to no one in my conviction that it's vital to our society. And if I weren't convinced that it could be accomplished, I wouldn't preach what I do, but I'm convinced that it can be accomplished. And let me give you some ideas on that subject. To begin with, I believe that we must bring our young people directly into the political process. That is why I have long favored and joined ardently others, including the majority leader of the Senate, in seeking to lower the voting age to 18, better to permit the process to reflect the idealism, the activism, and the energy of youth. Second, We need to reform our schools, our colleges, and our universities to meet the new generation's legitimate demand for participation. Our private and even our public universities are largely governed by trustees or boards of appointed officials. But in fact, a college or a university is a community composed not only of trustees and administrators, but also students and faculty. Students and faculty should get the chance to help set the policies of the colleges and the universities they attend. They should be involved as a faculty, albeit not necessarily a determining one, because they are not the majority, unless they earn it. And they should have a role, not as a reward for demonstrations, but simply because it makes good sense. And in private colleges, boards of trustees tend often to be small, self-perpetuating groups, which do not allow students and faculty members to voice their ideas. We must ensure the means for legitimate student and faculty influence. This was one of the real problems endemic at Columbia University. And we must afford the members of the college community, to which students and faculty, a meaningful voice in the higher educational affairs, which so vitally concern them. They're not children. They're entitled to an opportunity to persuade everybody that what they contend for is right. And if they can persuade, they ought to prevail. But if they can't persuade, they can't hit people over the head and make them do it. That's not a democracy. Third, our institutions of higher learning must become more relevant to what is involved in American life. In the same way as the land grant colleges of another day and the large tuition-free city universities, like your own, served as agents of technical and social change in earlier decades of this century, so the large urban universities and community colleges of today have a role to play beyond liberal arts education. They should be organized so that they're capable of improving the life of the cities in which they're located. They can serve a critical role in education, in job training, in health, and in many other activities. They should offer an education to their students that is directly related to the quality of urban life and to the challenges and opportunities of our time. Just as you hope the community will come to you, so you must know the community as an integral part of your college education. That's the fundamental point which I wish to make. You ought to be teachers, tutors, instructors, guides, leaders, morale builders in the community which surrounds you. And I believe all of these things are examples. The manner in which our urban institutions of higher learning reform themselves so that they're able to fill these roles cannot be decided on from afar by small groups of trustees and administrators. You as students, with a faculty, must play a role in developing these changes and new policies, as should the larger community, beyond the university gates. So let's have this dialogue, let's have our activists, but let's also have reform of our campus institutions. And let us not forget that the primary purpose of a great university or an aspiring community college is to offer an education. I repeat that, to offer an education which will equip graduates to deal with the problems of a complex society. I don't just mean that your degree is a passport to a good job, although for many of you it surely will be that, but it must also reflect a new maturity, a fresh wisdom that will enable you to view a disorderly world with added perspective and a keener sense of judgment. If a college education has provided you with this alone, to wit, a greater maturity and a keener sense of judgment, you should regard yourself as well rewarded indeed. I deeply feel that we can move America toward the fulfillment of our ideas, if we can avoid that violence which only retards change and encourages division. I was just asked by a radio reporter here a little while ago, in the light of what I'm saying here today, what would I have done about the protests of Columbia University, which is a typical example. What would I have substituted for violence in the sit-in in order to break open the matrix of that college community? And my answer was the following, and I think it's a legitimate answer. I deeply believe that if 10,000 students at Columbia had held a mass meeting every night for 30 days on the campus of Columbia University, they would show so unequivocally have impressed the university trustees and all of New York, indeed of the country and the world, that they would have gotten more than they're getting now, and no one would have been suspended. If we establish the means for understanding each other, and most important, if we view the generation gap not as an obstacle or as a reason for violent revolution, but rather as an opportunity for creative debate, for the chance to persuade through which a more just system of higher education and a more just society can finally emerge, we will be serving nobly not only our community of New York, but the country and the world as well. Now let me say finally, this is a dangerous hour, a very dangerous hour. There is deep disquiet, deep division in our country. We are a young country. We are not an old country. We haven't had it by a long sight in this country. We're just beginning on what should be a magnificent national destiny. But it can happen here. There is no assurance that this national destiny will be fulfilled. And there is no assurance that we won't, as so many people before us, notwithstanding our relative youth and the tremendous powerful good which we are in the world, destroy ourselves. And therefore, when I speak these words, I seek to articulate a call to action which can be constructive. The force of life is what we're interested in as adult people and as graduates in this country. The force of life, and I'm trying to chart out techniques by which the life force, which is inherent in young people, may generate the activity which the country so urgently needs, and perhaps even beyond activity, the high morale, the sense of purpose, the sense of being a united people which has courage and energy and the ability to accomplish things, and is not dismayed and cast down by what's occurred, or bedeviled by assassins, or by crime and violence. There will be crime, there will be violence, there will be assassination. We all know that. It's endemic in life. But are we prepared to meet it? And the danger in America today is that we're not. And it is that call to morale, that call to a better relationship of the individual to our society that I have tried to sound today for you at your graduation. Bless you all and thank you very much.
Second announcement, I've turned to March, Mr. Mayor, for hosting this party today. And I, too, would like to congratulate your winner, Mr. Polehill, and his parents, to express my thanks to Cyril Taylor. And this all comes about, Mr. Mayor, through my meeting him by sheer happenstance, and his asking me how to go about doing what we're doing today for the second time, and my telling him that the thing to do is to do it with you and with me. Seeking support in an area where it ought to be available to him.
Senator, what was your reaction, sir, to the appointment to the Supreme Court that the President made?
I do not wish at this particular moment to pass upon the quality of those appointments. I think very highly of Judge Fortas. I've known him for a very long time. I believe that former Congressman Thornberry, now a judge, is not in terms of being a legal scholar, et cetera, in the same category. But nonetheless, an honorable and creditable man, insofar as it represents.
All right. It's a
Today is the kickoff of the formal phase of my campaign for re-election. 6 months ago, when I announced my intention to run for re-election, I said the three overriding issues of the campaign would be the war in Vietnam, the crisis of the cities, and the inflation and the cost of living. Now the national conventions are over, and these issues still remain paramount. Indeed, the debate, the controversy, and even the violence of the last few weeks have given these problems a totally new urgency. This past week, for example, despite a valiant attempt by minority forces in the Democratic Party to get the administration to change the direction of its policies in Vietnam, that effort failed. And the Democratic Party clearly told the American people that as far as Vietnam was concerned, all we could expect was a continuance of President Johnson's policy. In this respect, I think the Republican platform holds more promise. It states plainly that the administration's Vietnam policy has failed, militarily, politically, diplomatically, and with relation to our own people. It's the end of a quote from the platform, and this is my view. Indeed, I helped write those words. Last February, I said that the Vietnam War cruelly perplexes and frustrates the nation, and that we must begin to end the Americanization of the war. I'm therefore gratified that the Republican Party adopted that policy in its national platform, and calling for a strategy that will permit a progressive de-Americanization of the war, both military and civilian. And I hope very much that Mr. Nixon will pursue that concept in the weeks ahead, as I believe this issue can be decisive for the Republican Party in this campaign. Now, it is true, of course, that both major parties obviously want peace in Vietnam. But I'm convinced that the American people want a totally new administration, freed from the mistakes and commitments of the past in respect to Vietnam. And I believe that the people, if given the chance by the policy which Mr. Nixon pursues on Vietnam, will feel that a new Republican administration is more capable of bringing the war in Vietnam to an early end, and I deeply feel that that's so. Finally, I want to comment on the events of the past week in Chicago, which have so dismayed and shocked the American people. It seems to me that the police state atmosphere, the assaults on the press, the spirit of repression, of expressions of dissent, and general pandemonium has raised serious questions in the minds of millions of Americans of the influence of machine politics on the Democratic Party, machine politics like those typified by Mayor Daley, an outmoded, obsolete, heavy-handed political boss. The events in Chicago, so tragic and humiliating to the nation, let alone the Democratic Party, raise serious questions whether the Democratic Party is capable of providing the nation with a sense of unity or whether it has a sensitivity to change, which is so necessary in the times in which we live. In the final analysis, I believe the National Convention of the Democratic Party in Chicago will provide added support for the deep national yearning for a total change in administrations.
Senator Javits, do you think your differences with Mr. Nixon on the Vietnam issue will hurt you or him in the New York State?
I don't believe they should hurt either. My differences are very well known. In the first place, I broke with the administration on Vietnam policy as long ago as February of 1967, very publicly and openly. Secondly, I brought my plank before the convention in Miami. I didn't get much support for it, but at least it was raised in the platform committee thoroughly.